It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. For today's show, I'm taking you to the Beluga Count that took place on September 9th, when more than 1,200 people gathered at viewing sites around Cook Inlet and made 260 sightings of whales. The event was organized by NOAA Fisheries and some other agencies and organizations as a way of making folks more aware of the whales and of doing some citizen science too, as the location of the pods, their movements, and even the identity of individual whales was observed, recorded, and collated. But for me and my daughter, the main thing about the day was it was a lot of fun to be outdoors in the sunny weather with a lot of other people who love the place we love and to learn about these magnificent animals. All right, so let's hear the recording from our day with the whales. On our first stop was Windy Corner on Turnagain Arm, where we met up with Verena Gill. She's a biologist with NOAA, and Verena was kind of the nerve center of this operation. And when we met, she was going through text messages that were flooding in from the other 11 stations.
Calm waters in Eagle Bay. Oh, that's funny.
I haven't seen anything yet, huh?
No, that's the J-Bear crew. Eagle Bay did see some, but they're just saying calm. It is very calm today.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So I have this text network. I have 10 people in one group and 10 on the other because it will only take 10 per group message, which is kind of a shame. So...
And they're just continuously updating.
They're continuously updating. Like here, like mile 111, two belugas near shore and about four in middle. Mile 94, one beluga, spout near power line.
And this is giving you the time, so you could probably track the same beluga on its way through, huh?
Yeah, Kincaid here. 2 to 3 adults and 2 cars milling around at the base of the bluff. Reports a whale swim north of Tidewater Slough. That's Girdwood. So, I mean, we're recording all marine mammals. So we've had reports of harbor seals at Girdwood and harbor seals at Port Mackenzie.
I've never seen harbor seals out here.
Well, Brianna, my daughter here, saw a harbor seal between here, which is Windy Corner, and Anchorage. So, yeah, we have harbor seals. There are harbor porpoise, too. We've seen a couple of harbor porpoise this year. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Look at the emojis.
I know. That's funny. 5 to 10 so far at Windy Corner. That was before I got here. That was Debbie. So that's sort of like the Turnagain crew, and then this is the Kinnick North crew. So that's a picture of those guys on a boat. Let's see here. Goose Bay here. No belugas yet, but we have 6 people. They were very excited, apparently. Had to clear a tree off the road to get here.
Wow. Goose Bay is way out there, so those are the real hardcore.
Yeah. Kincaid here. Biker reported seeing a few belugas at 8:15 a.m., but we've spotted none so far, but that was earlier. I mean, they've seen a lot now. 7 whales leaving Eagle Bay. That's on J-Bear, southbound on a flood tide. 15 belugas at Bird Point. We have whales south point of Eagle Bay. I mean, oh, look here, a seal at Point Mackenzie.
Cool. You wouldn't even think it, but, I mean, I guess you're not out looking all the time, so you don't necessarily see them all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think people drive down here and they'll see a couple here and a couple there.
If you're driving 60 miles an hour, you're a little less likely to see them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this makes you understand that here they are in the morning and they're spread all the way from Eagle River to 20 Mile, you know, just streaming along. And this point, we saw a mom and calf a little earlier, right next to the bluff, but this point here at Windy Corner, there's nowhere for them to really feed, so they're just traveling by. So when you see them, they're just kind of traveling along the bluff. They're whales that like tend to like shallow water, shallow coastal waters, and they're just traveling by Windy Corner. But they've been milling around at Kincaid, and they've been milling around at the Campbell Creek, Beluga Overlook, Campbell Creek Natural Wildlife Estuary. They'll be milling around at 20 Mile because there's food from there. So.
Yeah. And let's move over across the road here where it's a little quieter maybe.
Yeah, it is kind of a busy spot. And you just saw our law enforcement officer come by. He's going to all the stations just checking out. Everything's okay. We have permits to be here, and we've got to make sure people don't park on the side of the road. They have to park in parking spots and don't cross the railroad tracks. So we
Down at the last turnout, there are lots and lots of people.
Oh, were you at another turnout?
Just down here before, not part of your thing.
Oh, Beluga Point.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and Beluga Point's a great spot, and we really wanted to have a station there. The problem with Beluga Point is to get to the rock and the really great viewing station, you have to cross the railroad tracks. Mm-hmm. And
you didn't want to do that with an official... thing.
Well, you can't. You could get a citation. We definitely were working with the railroad, and they've been sharing our Facebook posts, and we're talking about partnerships with them next year. We had a train go by, and we were waving at everyone, but so that, you know, maybe next year passengers can report belugas. But we didn't want people crossing the railroad tracks, and at Beluga Point, people would, because that's the point right there. So
how did you choose the 12 stations?
Well, we have a a planning committee of about 20 people, beluga experts, and over the collective years of working belugas, it took a couple months to really refine the station list of where are the best spots to see belugas and what are the safest spots. And we don't want people, you know, just hugging the side of the road somewhere,
right,
especially along Turner and Arm. And we wanted them fairly accessible. There's a couple that you have to hike into, but most of them are pretty accessible. And couple that with historic sightings from those spots were kind of how we chose. But we went back and forth on a bunch of different sites.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, McHugh Creek is a great place to see them up in the parking lot, but that seemed like it was kind of far removed.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'd be curious to know how many people are over at Hope watching. That's a great spot, too.
Did you choose, this tidal cycle, the tide is so high, it's so beautiful down here with the tide high like this. Is that enhance the viewing because the whales can get closer to shore?
Well, we picked the 9th of September because we knew it would be calm and sunny. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I can't believe the weather. I mean, you know, sometimes
you could get more lucky, yeah.
I know. Turnagain Arm, you come down here and, I mean, you see 1,000 belugas because they're all whitecaps, right? It's hard to see them today. You're not going to miss a beluga. So it's beautiful.
Yeah.
The tide, we timed it with the tide because, yes, belugas use the high tide. They come in down Turnagain Arm on the high tide. And then go out on the outgoing tide.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, we definitely picked the time. You know, if it would be in the afternoon, we may have the zoo event in the morning and then the viewing in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So
why are they coming in with the tide like that?
Well, I mean, they can't access. For example, they like to feed the hooligan in May in the 20 mile and then the silver salmon down there now. I mean, there's a lot of salmon fishermen down there. But, you know, it's so dry down here until you got a lot of water in Turnagain Arm. You know, it's hazardous for them to go down there and potentially get stranded, and sometimes they can't even reach it because the water isn't deep enough, so they need that tide flooding down here to travel, follow the tide down.
Are the fish coming with the incoming tide as well?
I assume some of them are. You know, to be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot about silver salmon.
Uh-huh.
But the hooligan do. Well, the hooligan live here year-round. Here's a train. That's...
Oh my God. Look at the tourists. They're having so much fun.
They did. On the way up, we had a train headed to Anchorage. The train was honking. People were waving. It was kind of exciting. The railroad's definitely, you know, been advertising this event for us.
Oh, that's great. Well, I mean, there's a lot of organizations that put this together. It seems like a huge organizational thing. How long have you been working on it?
Believe it or not, pretty much only since pretty much March. I mean, January at the Alaska... symposium.
Mm-hmm.
My mind.
Marine
is
symposium.
Thank you, Alaska Marine Science Symposium. We had a beluga workshop, and there I stood up and said, "Is anybody interested in doing this kind of event?" And a few people came forward, and then we had a little meeting in February, and then we really got the committee together in March. So, honestly, I didn't think we'd be able to pull something like this off. I was suggesting that we did it next year, but I was amazed. So many people came together with so much enthusiasm. To do this, it was incredible. Other federal agencies like the Forest Service, they're running two stations at Hope and the 20 Mile. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, they're down at Girdwood running a station. And then we have a University of Alaska Anchorage for the Kachemak Bay campus. They have Semester by the Bay students. There's 16 of them here running this station at Windy Corner. Then we have State came together with us, Department of Fish and Game. They're running the Goose Bay Station and the Kincaid Station. And then we have NGOs like the Beluga Whale Alliance. They're down at Girdwood. The Friends of the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge have been a massive help to us. And just other dedicated individuals, people that just care about belugas, and came and helped us out because it was a huge job to organize the stations and the zoo and getting the mayor involved. And it came together because so many people care about belugas and wanted to help.
Yeah, 12 stations. I'm just sort of thinking about it now. How many volunteers are at each station, and the sort of the logistics of getting everybody out there, and then the thing at the zoo. It's like, how many people are involved in this thing?
I don't know, but I do know last night when I looked at the Belugas Count Facebook, I got I was excited and horrified because I thought if the 1,500 people that either said they were interested or were coming really came and 1,500 people tried to cram into Windy Corner, I'd have a major traffic problem.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was exciting. We were live streaming from here earlier and someone messaged in from Germany. Thank you for streaming. I'm watching it from Germany.
So how cool.
Kind of exciting, right?
Yeah.
And then someone was watching it from Kentucky. So, I mean, I was thrilled to see that many people interested, but then I did start to get a little bit worried about how many people are going to be here. And you see, like, more and more people are showing up. And
yeah, the lot's almost full.
Yeah, it is. So that's a bit exciting.
Yeah. So from a scientific standpoint, is there something that you're going to learn from this data, or is it more of a citizen awareness thing, and that the science part is really not that important?
I think it's both. I mean, definitely the awareness is a big part of it. Just teaching people about these amazing whales that live. I mean, someone came by and said, well, do these belugas, they migrate to Mexico in the winter, don't they? And I'm like, no, these belugas are our belugas. They live here year round. I mean, they're under the ice. They're here. She said, well, they don't have the calves in Mexico. I go, no, they have the calves right here with us. Huh? I mean, we have whales right next to the coast all year round with us. So that kind of awareness. Just, you know, building that just to educate people about belugas. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other part of that is year round, if people know that we're interested in having sightings, this is a one day event that, you know, hopefully we'll do year to year and be able to compare the data. But now if people know that we want their sightings from, you know, all year round, if you see a beluga in February in Eagle River, how cool would that be to let us know? I mean, we know they're up there, believe it or not, under the ice in Eagle River. Jay Bear have some acoustic monitors up there, and wow, they captured them under the ice in the winter in Eagle River. Who knew, right? So
it almost seems impossible because those huge moving icebergs seem like they would just crush anything living under them.
Right? I know. I don't know. I mean, we don't know a whole lot about them in the winter. And you know, a part of that in
like, and what are they eating?
What are they eating? We've talked about that. They're not eating salmon. Now, Hooligan may be year-round resident. Wait a minute, I'm getting another text here. New pod has come in up to 16 heading east. Heard them honking also.
Whoa! And who was that? Which station was that?
Kincaid. Can you go tell them that, Brianna? New pod come in 16 at Kincaid heading east honking.
Heading our direction or east up Kinnickarm?
Well, east would be... that would be up Kinnickarm.
Yeah, probably. But your viewpoint here, I mean, if there's any belugas in Turnagain Arm, you will see them.
Well, you know, I think people were looking beyond, and then they were all along the side.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were...
Did they just cruise along by?
Yeah, they did. They were right along the edge, along the cough. But so, you know, people can give us sightings that... So I'm flat to the winter. What are they eating? So Hooligan are in the inlet, we think, year-round. But, I mean, they're probably eating flounder. We know they eat flounder. We know they eat saffron cod, for example. So they're probably eating those kind of resident fish. We're not quite sure. There's so much that we don't know about these incredible whales. And, you know, are they, you know, going south? They used to be all the way to Houma. You know, and since the population shrunk from 1,300, they spend most of the time up here in the upper inlet. So, you know... Next year, I would love to expand this to Kenai.
Yeah.
And
there's a beluga park down there because you used to see them out there all the time.
Right.
When I was a kid, you used to see them coming into Homer. I guess they used to chase the herring in the springtime, and herring are gone. So I guess that a lot of changes.
Yeah, there are a lot of changes, and you know, there's a lot of critical habitat down there in Homer. So maybe if we have eyes on the inlet, not just one day a year, but if people are aware. And we've got eyes on the inlet 365 days a year. Maybe we'll see one in Homer. You know, I don't... Here, here's another text.
What do we got now?
Wow, Port Mackenzie. Yay.
Five whites and a gray.
Hard up against the port of Anchorage, seen from Port Mackenzie.
What? What is it?
You want to go tell them to radio that down there?
White and a gray.
Right. Brianna's a good helper, huh?
She is a good helper. She helped me find my phone this morning in all the panic. I put it on the roof of my car and drove off.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, I need it for live stream, for texting, and it was gone. And so I had my iPad, and she said, let's do find your iPhone, Mom. Thank goodness for 10-year-old technology, right?
Yeah.
She found it on the road about a mile west of my house.
Oh,
in the middle of the road. Look.
You must have been panicking.
I was, because it's like...
What are you going to do without it,
What
right?
am I going to do? I was hysterical. So she's like, well, let's just find my iPhone. I'm like, whew, thank God for the 10-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely.
So...
How many belugas, you mentioned that there used to be a lot more and you see them over a broader range of their habitat. How many do we think there are now, and how many did there used to be before the population crash?
Well, we're estimating between 300 and 400.
That's not very many.
It's not very many. And every 2 years we'll do a summer survey of them. And we do come up with a number, and the number we came up with in 2016 was 328. But, you know, obviously that's not the number that are there. I mean, that's a, that has a huge, well, not a huge, but it has a confidence in all around it.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, our best guess is between 300 and 400. And I say guess, it's not really a guess. There are between 300 and 400. But, you know, there's some noise in that because you are doing an estimate from an aerial survey. They're hard to see. But so we are doing aerial surveys next year in the usual June. But we're also doing some new surveys in March and November. We're working with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management to do that, to look at the winter distribution. Are they still further south, or are they just completely staying up in the upper inlet? So that'll be a challenge because there's short daylight hours and there's a lot of ice. So we'll see how that goes. But, you know, there's a lot more focus on belugas now because they're one of the species in the spotlight for NOAA fisheries. There are 12 species that they're trying to focus more energy on. They're critically endangered and focus more time and energy and money on finding out more about what we can do to recover them. And this belugas count, part of it came out of the recovery plan. We published a recovery plan in December 2016 for the belugas.
Because they'd gone down and the critical habitat was identified, but then they weren't really coming back up again.
No, they decreased rapidly, we think, because of over-harvest. But harvesting stopped by the native peoples, but they didn't recover. They're still declining about 0.5% per year. So why are they not recovering? And so this recovery plan was put together by a recovery team. We published it in 2016. And there are these recovery recommendations in the plan as a series of different research that people are suggesting this team of experts put together. And one of the things they suggested was some kind of citizen science count. And so I looked at that. I just joined NIMS a year ago from Fish and Wildlife Service. So I was kind of helping out, what could I do, and looking through the recovery plan. And here's this suggested action. So kind of went from there.
What was the number that we believe existed prior to the the reduction? I mean, was it like a couple thousand or?
Well, we're estimating about 1,300.
Uh-huh.
They were, you know, a small population. They are, right. You know, genetically and geographically isolated. You know, of course, there are other beluga populations in Alaska. There are 5 populations in total. And this is one of them, but these are, you know, geographically and genetically isolated from the other populations.
Yeah. So when we're watching them, we're looking for white ones that are the adults and the gray ones are the calves. And are you able to sort of say, okay, how many calves and so what the recruitment is and whether there's a chance they're going up or is it not that fine grain?
Well, there are many shades of gray.
Oh, okay.
So there are the real gray, dark gray ones, and they're the calves. And then you have lighter gray ones. And we're going to demonstrate this at the zoo, actually.
Okay.
And they're the juveniles. And then we have the white ones that are the adults. Although it has been known that some of the adults can be gray. In other places, not Cook Inlet, but in other places, you'll also see in the, some of them yellow. You know, they get tinged from some of the waters in the summer. You don't tend to see that in Cook Inlet, but yeah.
So when you're done with this, are you going to have like a, are you going to somehow collate all the sightings from today and like?
Yep, we are. In fact, I got to head to the zoo now because I realize how late I am. We are going to have everybody call in if they can't get there because some of the stations are a couple hours away from the zoo and tally and at 5 o'clock announce the results. How many people came, how many belugas were seen, how many adults, how many calves, and we're going to tally it and try and do a map and show where they were.
Cool.
Hopefully. We'll see. It's a little chaotic and mad right now.
Yeah.
And I got to run to the zoo and set up there. We got a whole bunch of activities there. I got to... Gotta go.
All right, we'll see you at the zoo. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, so we're at Windy Corner waiting for whales to come by. And what are your names?
I'm Allie.
Allie
Weber. Rachel Price.
And where are you guys from?
We're with the Semester by the Bay program in Homer, Alaska, but I'm from UNCW in North Carolina.
Oh, really? Cool.
I'm as well. Go to school at UNCW North Carolina, but I'm up here for the Semester by the Bay program.
All right. Well, I'm noticing that you guys are really bundled up as if it's wintertime.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm thinking like, oh, what a beautiful warm day. I wonder what the temperature's like down in North Carolina.
Oh, around this time, probably in the 80s.
Yeah. So how long are you spending in Homer?
We'll be in Homer for the entire semester, so through December, August through December.
So did you just get here?
We've been here for about 3 weeks now.
What kind of stuff have you been doing?
We've been doing a lot of marine mammal stuff. So last weekend we did take a trip over into Soldotna and into Seward. And in Seward we went on boat trip. We're able to see a lot of the whales and sea lions and all the wildlife that's out there.
So are you like a marine biology student, or are you undergraduate, right?
Yeah, so we're undergraduate students, and the Semester by the Bay program is for undergraduate students, mostly in marine biology focus, and it allows them to come and get a different type of experience up here in the North Pacific.
Yeah, that is very cool. I mean, North Carolina is a beautiful ocean state. You know, there's amazing aquariums there, and there's a really, really cool marine biology out in the Outer Banks and stuff. Do you guys spend a lot of time out there in those sounds and stuff?
We haven't been able to do a lot as regards to like class time, but like for fun, like we'll either go volunteer at the aquariums down there or take trips to, there's a sea turtle rehabilitation center, or just go out and like dolphin watch or stuff like that out to the different islands.
Yeah. So tell me what you're doing today. I see you've got some data sheets here.
So we are monitoring and counting the amount of beluga whales that we encounter in this position. And we're actually doing this big program with the Anchorage Zoo called Belugas Count. And there are different stations set up at multiple points along the Turnagain Arm. And we are all counting and recording the belugas that we see to try to determine if we're seeing new ones that haven't been recorded for a while, or even like higher numbers of calves to see if the population's growing, because currently it's really low numbers.
So how many have you seen this morning?
At this location, we've seen about 13 right now, but there have been reports both east and west of us of lots of other belugas coming in and out. Right now, the tide has just changed, so they should be heading a little bit outside of Turnagain Arm and more towards the water. That's the sandbars in Turnagain Arm can be really difficult, but they usually head in when the tide is high, so right now they're headed out.
Right, so they got to get out of here before they get stuck.
Yes, that is correct. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so anybody that went up that direction, you're probably going to see going back the other way if you're here long enough.
Yes, that's the hope. That's the hope.
Yeah. So how many did you see, and how many juveniles and how many adults?
So we've seen 13 total. We've seen probably about 2 to 3 calves. The calves are usually a grayer color. The adults can stay gray, and the subadults are usually gray as well, but they can be a white. It's easier to tell the calves apart based on the fact that they are gray and usually much smaller than the females as well, and the males.
Do you think that, I mean, this is a great citizen science project, you know, and it's obviously like getting a lot of people involved, and sort of the positive energy here is terrific. Do you think it has a real scientific benefit too?
Yes, we think we do. So with all the eyes out and all the cameras out, with programs like this, we are able to capture a lot of good images that can show identifying marks, which we use then in like NOAA or like the zoo, places like that, for identification catalogs to determine if there are more whales growing in this population, or if they're decreasing, or if like the ones that we've seen like years before are still alive today.
Great, awesome. Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer. For today's show, we're attending the beluga count that took place on September 9th on Kinnick Arm and Turnagain Arm. And after visiting Windy Quarter, we drove to Girdwood to see what was happening there. That site was being managed by folks with a new organization called the Beluga Whale Alliance and its founder, Suzanne Steinert. And what is the Beluga Alliance?
The Beluga Whale Alliance is a locally based nonprofit organization that we are currently launching. It launched in June of 2017, and we're based here along the Turnagain Arm in Girdwood, and it's devoted to the local and worldwide conservation of beluga whales. And here in the region, our main focuses are on supporting the conservation and recovery of this critically endangered beluga whale population we have in Cook Inlet, which is you know, arguably the most endangered beluga population in the world. Definitely in the U.S. So, yeah, we're really hoping to increase public participation in beluga conservation through events like this one. So Belugas Count is kind of our first. It is our first event that we've been involved in as an organization, which is very exciting. And also, we'd love to. We're planning to hopefully increase the tourism industry's involvement as well in beluga conservation. Also.
So how did the organization come into being? Because I've never heard of it until today.
Yeah, it's. We're brand new. We're still a baby. And we're still going through the process of 501c3 approval too. So hopefully we'll get that in the next couple of months. And but we are officially an incorporation with the state of Alaska. And I'm a graduate student. I'm Girdwood based, but I'm with the Miami University of Oxford, Ohio. And I'm in a global field program there in biology. And endangered species conservation is the focus of my program. So most of my projects. My focus on the program, most of my projects have focused on the critically endangered belugas we have here right in my front yard.
So it's kind of like activist science for you. I mean, you're like, rather than just studying, you're actually getting involved.
Exactly. Yes. And trying to promote their conservation. So I am doing my own research as part of my graduate studies here locally, monitoring their activity on the 20 Mile River in particularly and in the Arm. But I identified a need here locally for a local-based organization, really that helps get the community members along the Turnagain Arm more involved and educate them more about these whales and the issues surrounding them and their status as an endangered species, to really, like this event is doing, really try to build local pride in this population that people love to see as they drive up and down the highway. But there's kind of a disconnect between that love and, you know, passion that people have for them, but in actually being able to participate in their conservation. So, but this event is, you know, one of the first steps in doing that and bridging that gap. So,
And you've had a pretty good number of people here that you were able to proselytize and get them involved and stuff like that.
Yeah, we had, I wasn't counting the people. I was trying to more count the whales, but it seemed like we had a really great crowd here for at least about an hour and a half as we were observing whale activity. So I would say at least probably 50.
Oh, cool.
50 folks? Yeah, I mean, we had folks spread all over the rocks here, and we were trying to keep our voices down while we were observing the whales.
Oh, really? Yeah. So how close were the whales?
They probably came within, I would say, 20 to 30 yards was the closest that we had. But they were, as far, the group was pretty spread out, so as far out as like a quarter of a mile. But we were observing them milling all around the station here, a little closer to Girdwood and that channel where the highway curves, and then just over here to a little bit to the west, about a quarter of the mile to the south here, more towards the middle of the Arm. So we observed milling behavior. I didn't personally see any diving, no flukes personally, but some of the other folks might have caught it. Gentleman from Whittier actually observed spy hopping, which is when the whales actually like position their bodies vertically in the water column and lift their bodies up about halfway out of the water to kind of check out what's above the surface. So we definitely noted that in our sightings data sheets as a behavior that we witnessed. So we were collecting data on the number of whales. So we think we probably saw around five or so, and like Kai from Anchorage mentioned at least a couple gray juveniles and a harbor seal too we observed has been hanging around here all morning. Likely also here and present for the salmon that are currently spawning in the Arm.
So is you're working on a doctorate in
Master's.
Okay. And what is your research commonly just out here watching the whales, or what are you trying to find out in your research?
So I'm doing it's not a traditional master's thesis that I do in my program. It's more, we have a number of projects that are all tied together in a comprehensive master plan, it's called. So I've done projects locally, community engagement projects. So my master's has a big social component and human human dimensions components to it, to the wildlife biology degree. And so I've done a couple local events here in Girdwood for the local community members about the whales, just conservation updates, where I've talked about the draft recovery plan and then the finalized recovery plan. We've had biologists with the National Marine Fisheries Service and Cook Inlet Beluga Photo ID Project attend those events as well and speak and share their knowledge, which has been really cool. Also planners with the upcoming Seward Highway Mile Post 75 to 90 project talked about their planning process for that and how they worked with the National Marine Fisheries Service to make sure that their construction will not have a negative impact or any adverse impact on the whale population.
So. What an interesting program you're in. I've never even heard anything like it before.
Yeah, it's, thank you. not many people have. It's pretty unique, and I'm happy to get, I've got my card, you know, with the websites and has some more information about it. And then, my research that I'm doing this field season is a scientific inquiry project is down on the 20 Mile River, and I'm just monitoring whale activity, trying to document it extensively on that river for the first time during the ice-free months.
Neat.
Doing shore-based monitoring and also interviewing local members of the local boating community as well, fishermen and stuff like that, about their historic, their experiences of seeing whales on the river.
So in terms of your public outreach and interacting with people who live here, and I take it you're pretty new to Alaska.
I've been in this area for a few years, but I've started working in Alaska in 2010, kind of on a somewhat seasonal basis.
So you're not a total greenhorn.
I've weathered, at least a few winters up here by this point, four or so, and quite a few summers,
But I mean, Alaskans have kind of a complex relationship with the environment and environmental issues, and when the beluga issue first sort of came up, people were saying, oh no, they're going to stop development and all this, and so there's this, but what do you hear when you're working with the public? Is it mostly just love for the whales, or do you hear any of that, pick up any of that sort of conflicting points of view?
From what I've experienced so far, it's overwhelming positive support, and it's really like incredible. I've found, and people love the belugas, and I know they're a very iconic species in general, a charismatic species, as we say in conservation. Like well-known species like polar bears and elephants, and but it's really, I think people here do really value their presence, and they're a very unique population, and I think there has been an increase in pride in that just over the years that I've observed just since I've been living in this area and in this region that I live in. So people do care about them, and it seems like want to support their conservation. So.
And just that awareness and sort of knowing they're there and sort of opening our eyes and seeing them is really important, right? Because it's so easy just to drive down the highway and just keep your eye on the middle line.
Exactly. And it's good. You need to keep your eyes on the highway for sure. Always. That's the most important thing. But a lot of, and I'm trying to, the Beluga Whale Alliance are really trying to increase sightings reports as part of our work here too. I've, got a sighting system I've started and we're sharing.
Cool.
Yeah, we're generating.
Tell me how that works if people want to do it.
Yeah, we're generating local reports from locals who just see them have incidental sightings as they're driving up and down the highway, and we're starting to get a text message service going where folks can text us their sightings, and then we share those sightings with the group here locally for the Turnagain Arm, and that also, all of those sightings reports are logged as well in our database system that we're now sharing openly with other researchers also.
Cool.
So yeah, any sightings that our team has, we also log into that database too. So we really, just within the last 2 weeks exactly, we've had sightings essentially every day here in the Turnagain Arm, is really exciting. Yeah, and so hopefully those incidental sightings reports will be now used as well. Uh-huh. There'll be valuable sightings data that can be used to help support this population's conservation and maybe management decisions.
So if our listeners see belugas, they can sort of log into your site and just register them?
So we're still very new, so we're working right now. It's just really word of mouth.
Okay.
It's a lot of, I'm just trying to, I've kind of become, a local beluga gal here.
Yeah.
So people see me and they're like, hey, I just saw the whales.
But they could shoot you an email or whatever.
An email is great too. We do have a Facebook page, the Beluga Whale Alliance. science. So
we'll link that on our page.
Perfect. Yeah, we've just started getting sightings reports that way, and we share all of our sightings, like I've mentioned, sightings reports with actively with the other researchers as well, like the Cook Inlet Beluga Photo ID Project, also that is doing long-term monitoring as well of the whales in the inlet, and also they really like photographs. So any photographs we get, we pass along to them. High res photographs that can help them identify individual whales and track individual whales.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So people want to get involved. The good way is through the Facebook page for the Beluga. Beluga Whale Alliance.
Yes, correct. To start, and then look forward this winter to get more official and formal, a more official and formal system going.
Yeah, really cool. It's really great to see your energy and all this, you know, positive. Positive stuff happening around these animals.
Thank you. I think it's needed. We've got to keep the attitude and keep the conversation positive. That's what these guys need, I think. So, yeah.
All right.
I know there's a lot of complex issues, but we got to all work together.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will see you at the zoo, I guess.
Yes.
All right.
See you there. Thanks so much, Charles.
We're continuing with Outdoor Explorer and my visit to the Beluga Count event happened a couple of weeks ago. I'm Charles Woolforth. The counting of the whales finished around noon, and then everyone gathered at the Alaska Zoo on MLA Road. The Gateway Center at the zoo had a series of tables with information about whales and baked goodies and, of course, speeches by VIPs to mark the event.
Thanks for being here today. I'm John Kurland. I'm with NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service. I'm based in Juneau, and I supervise the group that's responsible for conservation and recovery of marine mammals throughout Alaska. Today is the first run of what we're hoping is going to be an annual event involving communities around Cook Inlet to participate in observations of this really iconic species, this population of beluga whales, to learn more about what they're doing in Cook Inlet, the threats that they face, and how we can all help recover this endangered species. We think there were about 1,300 Cook Inlet beluga whales as recently as 1979, but the population declined sharply after a period of increased and unsustainable subsistence hunting pressure in the 1990s. NOAA worked cooperatively with our Alaska Native partners to regulate the hunting, and we anticipated that the population would respond and recover and turn around steadily, but unfortunately that hasn't been the case. I won't go into all the history here, but in 2008, NOAA Fisheries developed a conservation plan for Cook Inlet belugas, and we listed the species under the Endangered Species Act. We designated critical habitat for the whales in 2011, and we worked with a recovery team, including a science panel and stakeholders, to develop a recovery plan for these whales, which we just finished in December of last year. Creating an annual beluga watch day for this population is something that was identified in the recovery plan, so we're really happy to use this event to begin implementing that action with help from the public. Last year, our agency also recognized Cook Inlet belugas as one of eight species in the spotlight, we're calling them, so one of just eight species nationwide that are endangered and are at serious risk, but ones where we think we can make some progress towards recovery with a renewed and dedicated effort from NOAA and its many partners. So in that spirit, it's really fantastic to see all the enthusiasm and partners helping us with our inaugural belugas count. So at the risk of leaving somebody out, I'd like to acknowledge the many groups and individuals who are participating in belugas count today and who are partners with us in supporting Cook Inlet beluga recovery, and I'll just read off a list. So thank you to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the Alaska Sea Life Center, the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center, the Alaska Zoo, the Beluga Whale Alliance, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, the Cook Inlet Beluga Whale Photo ID Project, Defenders of Wildlife, Friends of the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge, the U.S. Forest Service, the University of Alaska Anchorage Kachemak Bay Campus, committed individuals from Anchorage and other communities, and thanks also to our dedicated staff at NOAA Fisheries. This Belugas Count event really would not be possible without all of you, and we need help from all of you to continue the recovery of Cook Inlet beluga whales, so thank you very much. Last but not least, I'd like to thank the municipality of Anchorage. We're delighted to have Mayor Ethan Berkowitz with us here today, who I understand has a proclamation to share with us. So without further ado, Mr. Mayor, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks for giving me a chance to spout off about whales a little bit.
Can I help you with that?
Yeah, if you would be so kind.
Yeah.
You know, we live in a time where facts matter, data matters. When we make policy about places that we live, it's important for us to do it based on a real understanding of how many whales there are, what the consequences are for the decisions that we make, and to try and do anything like that in a vacuum, to make decisions in a vacuum, or to make decisions based upon opinion is going to lead to bad decisions. So it's an important thing to also remember that one of the bedrock Alaskan values is that we're good stewards of our environment. For 10,000 years, people have been pursuing animals, taking care of the environment here. And that's an ongoing responsibility that we have today. And there's a lot of development pressures in this state. There's a lot of challenges to doing things the right way. But we cannot make the decisions about doing things the right way until we have the right facts. And on account of that, it gives me pleasure. I don't have a lot of perks as mayor besides a parking place and the ability to make proclamations. And I'm going to read just portions of it, and I'll leave it for others to come read. But whereas in 1979, Cook Inlet beluga whales numbered about 1,300 and were said to be present as far as the eye could see, but in response to a dramatic decline in the Cook Inlet beluga populations, NOAA Fisheries was petitioned to designate Cook Inlet belugas as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. And whereas a healthy ecosystem abundant with the diversity of marine life in Upper Cook Inlet, frequented by Cook Inlet beluga whales, contributes to the enjoyment, sense of wonder of natural habitat, and quality of life for all residents of the municipality of Anchorage, Alaska. And whereas belugas signify by their existence in Cook Inlet a diverse ecosystem close to a major city, providing a valuable asset to the community, now therefore I, Ethan Berkowitz, do hereby proclaim September 9th, 2017 as Belugas Count with an exclamation mark day in Anchorage, and encourage all of our residents to document the presence of Cook Inlet belugas every day and participate to help recover this endangered species. So thank you. And thank you to all of you and to all the organizations that are engaged in making sure that Anchorage is a great place to live. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of different people for that to come to pass. And I am, as not only as mayor, but as someone who lives here, grateful. So thank you all very much.
This is Outdoor Explorer. In addition to the speech by Mayor Berkowitz, scientists and educators talked about beluga at the Beluga Count event on September 9th, including Alex Havens of the Alaska Sea Life Center, who spoke in the downstairs classroom at the zoo.
When it's hearing that sound. And so we will basically put these sensors on there and then start making the sound, and we'll start it really quiet. And we'll raise it up in volume. And we'll raise it up in volume. And we just keep raising it in volume until the body actually says, hey, there's a sound. And when we do that, we can chart out what the lowest volume, there's our sensors, you can chart out what the lowest volume you can hear it. So this is with humans. This little thing down here is kind of a keyboard. So we can actually hear quieter volumes of the middle notes there, but as we go out to the extremes on either end of our hearing range, it has to be louder for us to hear it. So that's where a human is. This is where dolphins and belugas are. So belugas are even beyond the dolphin. They can hear a little bit lower of a tone, but then they can also hear very, very quiet sounds. Right? Now, what might they be using their ability to hear for? What do belugas use sound for? Yeah.
To find their prey.
Maybe to find their prey. I heard communication over here. Those are both great. So they use echolocation to find their prey. And that's where we got to foraging behavior. So I mentioned we wanted to run some tests on these animals in the field. What are they doing when they're not just there at the shore with us? And in order to do that, they wanted to look at their foraging. How do they catch their prey? And we just said they might use sound. So that's this bottom part down here. We wanted to understand better the sounds that we were hearing. And then we also wanted to measure where they were when they ate fish. How deep were they when they were catching food? How fast were they moving in order to catch that food? And also their stomach temperature. And that could be a tool for us because they eat cold-blooded things. Those are animals, fish or squid or octopus, whatever they can get a hold of, right? Those are going to be the same temperature as the water. But the whale is warm-blooded. So its stomach temperature, when it's just swimming around, is going to be pretty hot. But the second they eat a cold fish, it's going to make their stomach temperature go down. If they eat a really big fish, it'll go down more than if they eat a teeny tiny little fish. So by doing this over time, we can actually figure out, hey, if we see a drop in their stomach temperature this big, then we know they ate a fish this big, and we can estimate how many calories they're actually eating. It's pretty cool. But in order to do this, right? And the sounds, I wanted to say, come out of that big rounded knob on the front of their face. It's called a melon. And I found out there's actually a plane called the Airbus Beluga that's got that big old melon shape on it. And they actually use that in the wild. The whales are using this to send out that echolocation. So we knew they used that echolocation. That was the other part of this study we were going to look at. So what we did is we attached some tags that would stay with the animal when they go out. And one of those tags is a satellite transmitter. So that would actually beam the information up to a satellite. We didn't have to follow this animal in order to get that information. And eventually that tag is just gonna pop right off and it floats over to shore. A lot of times they're kind of brightly colored and we will get those back oftentimes. But in the meantime, before it falls off, it's gonna send us a lot of data. And this is some of the data it was sending us. So we could tell how deep they were based on the pressure that those sensors felt. We could listen to them, and this is them actually using their echolocation, and we could tell how fast they were moving. There was an accelerometer in there that would tell if the animal was accelerating or decelerating through the water. And so what we can see here is actually them catching a fish. So their depth changes a little bit. That's just going to be dependent on where the prey is going. Their feeding sounds change a little bit. They're kind of doing some little clicks over there on the left. And then as they are zeroing in on prey, those clicks are getting closer and closer and closer and closer to each other, right? They're really zeroing in. And when they are chasing prey, there's this big acceleration, right? They're not moving too much to the left of that. And then there's a big acceleration to start that sprint. And then they're kind of speeding along. And since this is on a little satellite tag, we can actually see where they're catching each fish. So each of these little black dots up there, they are red, but again, this color is kind of weird on here. Each of those dots is a spot where it recorded them eating a fish and again, or some other prey item. And again, we know they're eating things and roughly how large they are because this is what their stomach temperature looks like when they eat something. It goes from kind of a base level and then they eat something really cold, right? The temperature of the water around it, and it just drops that stomach temperature down. And then as they're digesting that, it raises back up to beluga temperature and then it drops that temperature back down the next time they eat something. And so by doing this, we can actually figure out how often they're eating and how much energy maybe they're spending if we know how fast they're moving. And then we can estimate how big the prey was so we can figure out how much energy they're getting back from all this. So kind of a cool study. And these are just photos of the researchers at that study. Sometimes the whales would splash quite a lot and you might get caught in that in the very cold water. And that's the research that's going on out in the field. But now, because of this beluga count, we are actually able to help ourselves, right? Whenever I drive up and down that highway, I'm always looking, are there belugas? And so to open this up to the public and allow anytime someone sees belugas, you're just like, hey, I saw a couple over here. And that helps the researchers out in the field. Because you might imagine, just looking at this presentation, that's a lot of work. And so everyone can help now. And I think that's great. And hopefully you learned a little bit about not only how long the belugas live, but also what it takes to get that sort of life information. So, thank you.
That was Alex Havens of the Alaska Sea Life Center at the Beluga Count event. Before leaving the event, I also caught up with Mandy Magura, who coordinates beluga recovery for NOAA. Well, right now I'm with Mandy Magura, who's the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Coordinator for at NOAA for the Protected Resources Division. And so you have the responsibility to sort of like caretake and oversee these whales and try to bring them back to their former numbers. What are some of the strategies that are being used to do that?
Well, one of the things we're working through Species in the Spotlight campaign is to try to garner more partnerships. But we recognize at NOAA that it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of resources and a lot of different types of activities to recover the coconut beluga whales. So we're really trying to reach out to a lot of partners to get support to help doing that, because we recognize we can't do that alone. And recovery is going to be a slow process, and it's going to take a lot of effort.
Do we have any theories as to why the recovery is not happening?
Well, we know in the early 1900s, we know that in the early 1990s, in the mid-1990s, there was subsistence harvest that was at levels that were unsustainable for this small population. Mm-hmm. So we worked with the local native groups to regulate the harvest, and they voluntarily stood down because it was important to them as well. And so we had hoped by regulating the harvest that we would start seeing this population recover, but we haven't. The numbers haven't been increasing like we were hoping they would. And so through the process of developing a recovery plan, we have identified 10 categories of threats, and we've gone through and looked at different factors and ranked them as high, medium, low concern. So through the recovery plan, we're really going to be trying to focus on those medium and high threats right now. We're recognizing the low threats are still a threat, but trying to kind of focus our resources on the high and medium. And what we really became clear through that process is that there is no single threat by itself that seems to be what's causing the decline. Mm-hmm. So there's a good chance it's a little bit of a lot of things. And so we have to take kind of this broad approach towards recovery.
So I know this recovery plan is a fairly new document. Is it based on the research that you've done to quantify these threats, or is there a little bit of guesswork involved because it's so hard to really know what the cause and effect is?
So the recovery plan was actually a long effort in the making. We had a recovery team that helped us out, included a science panel and a stakeholder panel, and over 30 members on that. And through that process, it is a summary of the best available information, and also what we know about the belugas, and also what we know about the threats to the population. And so it was this really intensive effort to look at all these different pieces.
So you mentioned that there are 10 items. What are some of the high impact items?
So some of the threats that were ranked as a high concern were noise, catastrophic events, things that might result in mass mortalities, and cumulative effects of multiple stressors. And that's what I was saying. There's not really one single thing alone that is really pointing up to why they're recovering. So it's probably an accumulation of all these little things together. So those are what we have identified as the high threats in the recovery plan.
So how would noise affect their ability to recover?
Well, in Cook Inlet, because the water is so murky, so turbid, vision is really limited. So Cook Inlet belugas really rely heavily on their ability to hear and navigate the environment and to communicate with each other. And Cook Inlet in of itself is a naturally noisy environment already, so they're already kind of in a loud environment. And so when humans are putting additional noise into the environment, it's making it even more challenging for the belugas to be able to hear. And so we've identified noise as a concern, because if it gets so loud that they can't communicate, they can't navigate, they can't avoid prey or find prey or avoid predators, then it could result in reduced fitness or even worst case mortality.
So would NOAA look at sort of trying to limit industrial activities like, you know, oil drilling or construction or boating or those kinds of things to protect the beluga from noise?
So what we've done recently through the Endangered Species Act Section 7 consultations, where we have to look at the effects of federal agencies' actions on Cook Inlet beluga whales, is we've identified that the area around the Susitna Delta is really important to Cook Inlet beluga whales seasonally. It's an important foraging area, it's an important reproductive area, and at certain times of the year, just about the entire population can be found in that area. So through our Section 7 consultations, we have identified the Susitna Delta area as an area where we want to limit some of the really loud noises. So we do have some mitigation and time area restrictions for certain noise-making activities in those areas.
I see. What about toxicity and pollution and that sort of thing? We have our sewage treatment plant in Anchorage, which is pretty unique nationally, and only having primary treatment. It doesn't have the secondary or tertiary treatment that other communities have. And so you wonder, like, what are we putting out in the water, and could that be affecting the belugas?
Right. So in the past, from some of the samples that we had from subsistence harvested animals, when we were working with them researchers, we did look at some of the traditional contaminants in the belugas levels, and we didn't really find a large signal of concern in Cook and the beluga compared to some of the other Arctic populations. What we are in the process right now is we're working with some of our partners to collect some prey items, various fish species around Cook Inlet, focusing on Upper Cook Inlet because that seems to be where the belugas are, and we're collecting those, and we're going to be analyzing for a slew of some of these emerging pollutants of concern, some of the new things, some pharmaceuticals, personal care products, and testing to see if in the beluga prey any of those seem to have high signals. And then we can go back and look and see if that is of a concern for Cook and the beluga whales.
So there's obviously a lot of care for these animals, and just the event today was amazing to see all the people out and sort of the positive emotions that people have about belugas, and they love them and they want to protect them. What could sort of, as Anchorage residents or South Central residents, what could we do? I mean, what sort of actions can we take personally that would benefit these species?
Well, there's actually just some little small things. Everyday small things can really help. In Alaska, we like being out on the water. So if you're out boating on the water, give beluga space. So we're promoting staying 300 feet away from them if you're on the water. If a beluga does approach you while you're boating, if it's safe to, put your engine in neutral and wait for the belugas to swim by. Similarly, we also like to fly. We're a lot of pilots up here. So if you're flying over Cook Inlet, we also ask to give them some space. And don't circle over them and don't go below 1,500 feet if you see belugas. We have seen some instances where low-flying, circling aircraft have resulted in a change to beluga's behavior. So giving beluga space is important. We're also asking if people see stranded belugas, and that's a dead stranded animal or a live stranded animal, to contact our hotline right away. And that number is 877-925-7773. And the reason is we want to go out as fast as possible to learn as much as we can about these animals. And even dead animals provide a lot of information about the health of the animal that we can extrapolate to the health of the population. It also gives us some information if there are human interactions involved. We have seen some dead animals that had some significant blunt force trauma that very well might have been a vessel strike. So another reason we're asking people to give belugas space on the water. So there is a lot of information. So just little things.
Yeah.
In Anchorage, many of our storm drains don't get filtered before they go out into Cook Inlet. So be mindful of where your debris is going. Mm-hmm. Don't pour things down the storm drains, any chemicals, because that all gets flushed out into beluga's environment.
Yeah, it'd be really nice if we can coexist.
Yes, yeah. It would be. So hopefully just kind of these little things, everyday little things can add up. And just like I think the threats, there's no one single thing. It's a little bit of a lot. I think the other's true. If we all do positive actions, just a little bit, and a lot of us doing them can add up and will help.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Mandy McGurra, she is the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Coordinator for NOAA. From the Protect the Resources Division. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for today's Outdoor Explorer. I hope you enjoyed learning about the beluga count that took place this fall, maybe the beginning of an annual event. If it is, I recommend you go out and join it. It was a lot of fun. I want to thank our producer today, Eric Bork, and assistant producer, Hannah Duro, who lines up guests. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.